Thank you, everybody, for joining us on our call today. I'm Gareth Hatch with Technology Metals Research, also known as TMR, and I'm pleased to be joined on the call by Mickey Fulp, known throughout the industry as the Mercenary Geologist. Hello, Mickey.
Hello, Gareth.
So, without further ado, let's get into our discussion. Mickey, I know when you talk publicly, you normally like to make a statement, a disclaimer before you get started. Is that something you'd like to do at this point?
Yes, it is. Everyone on this call and everybody that ever hears me should realize that I am not a financial analyst or a certified financial analyst. I'm basically a dumb field geologist who got into the speculating in junior resource stocks very early on in my career and have done well basically because of my geological background. So nothing I talk about today can be construed as investment advice or recommendations to buy or sell, go long or go short in any sort of speculation in the market. That said, let's go.
All right, no problem. The views expressed on the call are those of their respective owners only and do not necessarily reflect the views of anyone else on the call. So you've been involved in the resource sector for quite some time now. Perhaps you could tell us how you got your start and about the twists and turns that led you to this point.
Yeah, well, I got started when I went to graduate school. I went to an oil school for an undergraduate degree, but always wanted to go into hard rock geology. So I chose the University of New Mexico to do my master's degree very early on. Within that tenure, which ended up being quite long, I took a summer job in the mineral industry and kind of found my home. And as I alluded to, it took me longer to get a master's degree than a bachelor's degree, and that's basically because I kept quitting and going to work as a field geologist, which is what I really enjoyed.
So these days you write a regular newsletter as part of your mercenarygeologist.com website. How long have you been doing that, and what led you to start writing that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll back up a little bit and say throughout my career, which is well over 30 years now, I have always been called upon to do evaluations and analysis. Starting very early on in my career, I did evaluations of projects. I spent a tenure with Santa Fe Pacific Mining in the early to mid-1980s. I was on a team of people that evaluated projects for mergers and acquisitions, joint ventures, business combinations, etc. I was a key geological member of that team, mostly engineers and financial types. So I've always had a background as an analyst. In about 2007, the company I was working for at the time started to go belly up, and I went out looking for an analyst job. I was retained by Jay Taylor for a few months to evaluate many of his companies and with a real goal to cut down on the number of companies he covered. After a few months, my job was done there, and I became a full-time analyst, basically hung out my shingle. This would have been in around July of 07. In April of 08, I launched mercenarygeologist.com. I wrote my first article, at which time I said, I don't have the discipline, the dedication, I'm too busy, and I don't want to write a newsletter. I'll never write a newsletter. 3 months later, I was writing a newsletter. It's not really regular. I write when I have something to say. On average, I write 2 to 3 times a month.
Okay. So these days, you see yourself primarily as a newsletter writer, or you're still a geologist first and foremost, or an analyst, or all three?
Well, I'd say I'm a bit of all of the above. Probably more than anything now, I consider myself part an analyst, but I very much concentrate on media. My business is increasingly moving toward comments on commodities and companies via radio, via a conference call interview such as this, and through television appearances. So the first year of the business, I concentrated on writing. The second year, I concentrated on radio, and now my concentration is on business television. So we've kind of gone into a multimedia sort of business model. But the real goal of this is to educate lay investors to make better business decisions, with the idea that if we can give the retail lay investor the tools to do his own due diligence and research, then he becomes a better investor. He makes better decisions on companies in the junior resource sector. Therefore, he will make more money. He will continue to speculate in the sector. And that creates more liquidity and volume, and more liquidity and volume, as we all know, creates a more boisterous and robust market with higher market caps. So it becomes a win-win situation for everyone.
Sure. Now, within the sector, you don't just specialize in one area, right? I mean, what areas of the resource space are you particularly interested in, and why?
Yeah, well, that's another good question. I have always considered myself a generalist and not an expert. I've had something on the order of 7 or 8 different careers within my plus 30 years. Every once in a while, I change what I'm doing, which gives me new incentive to be productive. So I would say I concentrate in hard commodities for the most part. Right now, my interest is probably first and foremost in uranium, because as a contrarian, I'm always looking for things that are beaten up or the next big thing. I've done a lot of work on the rare earths very early on, participant in the rare earth sector. I covered Avalon in June of 07, back when most of the world didn't know what a rare earth element was. Sometimes I wonder if they still do with the confusion with rare metals. The basis of what I do, of course, has to be gold, because gold is what controls and moves the junior resource markets on the Toronto Exchange. I am interested in copper. I was just in Toronto. I still keep my hands in the geology game. I was building a new geological model for a company that has an advanced copper project in Chile. So any kinds of hard commodities, and I know enough about oil and gas probably to be dangerous, but I dabble in oil and gas too.
So at what point, you know, beyond the technical side, the analytical side of this sector and your involvement there, at what point did you actually start investing in some of these stuff?
Well, I got my start in the junior resource sector in 1992. I put together a deal between my former employee, Santa Fe Pacific Mining, on a project I ran for 7 years for them, a massive sulfide deposit in northern New Mexico in the Pecos Greenstone Belt. I did a deal with one of my junior contacts. I received a finder's fee of stock and cash. I took that stock, which at the time amounted to something on the order of two tranches, $20,000 worth of stock, and got myself a good broker in Vancouver and started speculating in the sector. So nearly 20 years now.
Okay. So before we talk a little bit about resources and reserves, question, what was it that drew you to geology in the first place?
Well, I grew up in southern Missouri in the tri-state lead zinc belt. My grandfather was a driver in the zinc mines near Aurora, Missouri. A driver was someone who drove the ore carts pulled by mules out from the mines and to the ore bin. So as a kid, I was always an out-of-doors person. Explored the caves of that part of Missouri and swam in the mine holes and ran around on what they call the chat piles, which is the mine dumps. So I always had that interest. I went to college as a petroleum engineer on full scholarship. After about 2.5 years, I'd gotten rid of through all my calculus and physics and chemistry and started taking engineering courses, decided I did not want to sit behind a desk crunching numbers or spend the majority of my career on an offshore rig. So I looked around and said, what am I going to do? Am I going to be a chemist or a geologist? I ended up wanting to work outside, so I became a geologist. I ended up with a minor in chemistry, which has served me well in exploration and also the understanding of rather complicated material science, such as happens with the rare earth elements.
Sure. Very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about some of the terminology in this sector. And I know you do a lot of sort of educational talks and things as part of what you do. How do you define an ore body or an ore deposit, and what are the differences between so-called mineral resources and mineral reserves?
Well, it's not only how I define it, it's how it's defined. And an ore deposit, or an ore body, an ore deposit, a mineral deposit is basically something that can be mined at a profit. So it has economic parameters put on it. The difference between a mineral resource, which we commonly see these 43-101 resources, and a mineral reserve is resources have no economic parameters put in them. They are essentially the amount of material contained within the ground at some specific grade. So there is no any kind of studies done that would indicate it can be extracted profitably, whereas a reserve has, there's on the order of 9 different factors, mining costs, metallurgical costs, legal, environmental, socioeconomic, a whole litany. There's actually what is called the 9 qualifying factors to convert a mineral resource into a mineral reserve, and those are basic economic factors in analysis.
Right. So, and you mentioned there the 43-101 guidelines. What are those, and how are the definitions that you mentioned sort of codified for mineral projects?
Yeah, the 43-101 guidelines are a set of regulations that basically define this stuff. And so there are 3 categories of mineral resources. Those are inferred, indicated, and measured, and those are in order of increasing geologic knowledge and confidence about their existence. And then 2 of those categories, indicated and measured, can with further study categorized into reserves, and those would be probable and proven reserves. Listeners should be very aware that an inferred resource cannot be converted into a reserve without being upgraded into either an indicated or measured resource. So an inferred resource has very little meaning. It is essentially geochemical anomaly and is a geological mineral inventory in the ground. So from that point of view, very few inferred resources in the junior resource sector will ever be converted into proven or probable reserves, and they have to be upgraded into measured and indicated resources before that can happen.
So what type of additional work is actually required then, Mickey, to take a project from inferred to indicated and perhaps ultimately to measured?
Well, generally what is done is closer space drilling. For instance, we will see, let's take a typical gold deposit, and a company will come in and do maybe 2 or 3 programs of drilling and and calculate a 43-101 qualified inferred resource. And for example, that might be drilled on 200 meter centers. In other words, there's a drill hole on a grid every 200 meters. To convert that to an indicated resource is going to require likely 100-meter center drilling or 50-meter center drilling. So you see this conversion, you see closer space drilling and more data generated. It can also happen by underground exploration. For instance, if you go underground on an inferred resource and you, say, drive an adit, which is basically a tunnel with one opening, and you take what are called channel samples along the sides of that adit, those are systematic samples that could be used to upgrade a resource from inferred to indicated. Oftentimes we see very little in a measured category because that requires very detailed analysis, and it is not always necessary to develop a significant amount of measured resources before you can convert to a probable reserve.
Interesting. So, in your experience, what is the typical conversion rate from one level of these resource estimates to another?
That's a very difficult question to answer, but let's talk in very general terms. I would say that perhaps only 10 to 20% of the inferred resources that companies calculate would ever be converted into a reserve. Commonly, most of the inferred mineralization, if it is viable, if it is rigorous and viable, a significant amount of that can be converted into an indicated resource. The real difficulty here is getting to the reserve category, and that's basically mined at a profit, and I cannot emphasize in any too much that at a profit is really the key. So if you do end up with a measured and indicated resource, then and the deposit is economically robust, you will have dilution and loss because a proven and probable reserve can never be as large as a measured and indicated resource. And the reason is mining is an exact science. So you have dilution, meaning in a mining situation, there will be waste rock included within the ore because mining is a relatively inexact science. And by the same token, there will be losses because some of the ore will end up in the waste pile. And that's easy to visualize, especially in an open pit mine where you use big earth-moving equipment that has some limitations on its ability to go in and extract the material right on the contact between ore and waste.
So the definitions for the 43-101, are they similar to the JORC and other codes that are out there?
Absolutely, very equivalent. So the 43-101 regs would be very similar to the JORC code, which is the Australian methodology, the Joint Ore Reserves Committee code, and then also on the London Exchange, the codes used on the AIM Exchange are also very similar. And you're a Brit, so you can probably remember the name of those codes easier than I can. I think it's the Institute of Mining and Metallurgy in Britain, something like that.
Yep.
And there's also similar codes in South Africa. So, and each stock exchange will pretty much recognize the other's codes within some, you know, you're going to have to convert it, but it's going to be very similar.
Okay, so we sometimes see reference to historic resources not being compliant with one of the more recent codes? What sort of work is required to convert that type of data or that kind of resource into a 43101 or other resource estimate?
Again, that will be project specific, but a historic resource is one essentially that the data was generated prior to 2001 when the 43101 regs were accepted, and those regs were developed by the Canadian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy. So any data that was generated prior to 2001 is considered historic and has to be converted to 43101. In some cases, those historic resources were considered reserves in the past, but I have this little saying, what is ore today may or may not have been ore yesterday and may or may not be ore tomorrow. So we have this critical time factor. Generally, to convert to 43101, a lot of times you have to duplicate data. You have to duplicate or what is called twin drill holes. You have to generate more data. A historic resource, much like an inferred resource, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're really not even worth the paper they're documented on. In particular, you need investors should be very wary of anything on the resource end that has come from the former Soviet Union and also China, because they don't have the sort of categories we have or the rigorous requirements and qualifications that we have.
Right. I know part of the process of making these definitions is the involvement of a so-called qualified person. Who qualifies as a qualified person? What type of individuals?
Geologists and engineers qualify. And the way they do that is different in different part of the world, but again, much like the JORC code and the British codes and the 43101, there is an agreement that if, for instance, I'm a qualified person because I am a certified professional geologist in the United States. There in Canada, it's a province by province thing, and you will see professional geologist or professional engineer. Australian geologists and engineers are basically licensed or become qualified persons through the Australian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy. So there's a variety of ways. For instance, if you're a state recognized registered geologist in Wyoming, you will be accepted in Canada and California and the United States and Australia and vice versa. So for the most part, there is a very concerted effort to make sure that you're accepted in various jurisdictions. And that's especially because we almost all operate in the Canadian sector, whether we're Americans, Australians, Brits, or South Africans. A qualified person is able to sign off on data and say, I have reviewed this, I stand behind it and accept it as real. So there is some liability being a qualified person. A qualified person has to sign off on every press release at a general issue.
Interesting. And presumably there's some minimum experience level to become a qualified person.
Yes, that's very true. You've got to have experience. In some places, you've got to take a test. It's not a simple or easy category to acquire. So, and that's an effort to keep the snake charmers and the charlatans and the sharks out of the business. And this all basically came about because of the BRIEX scandal and a couple other scandals in the mid-90s.
Okay. Now, you've talked in the past about dimensions in geology, two dimensions versus three dimensions, even four dimensions. Could you elaborate on that? Because I think it's quite an interesting concept.
Yeah, this is a thing I came up with 4 or 5 years ago. I recognize that as geologists, we work mainly in two dimensions. When we make geologic maps, we're essentially making a map of the surface. Now, that surface can be curved, and so you consider a mountainous area. So, but that's still a two-dimensional curved surface. Now, what we do as geologists, the very good geologists, or actually probably geologists, if they're worth their salt, they have some innate and also acquired ability to think in three dimensions. So, for instance, when I'm walking around in the mountains making a surface geology map, I am thinking, what's below the ground here, and how can I test my theories? Because an ore deposit is not a two-dimensional body; it's a three-dimensional volume. It is a volume.
Yeah.
So the best geologists operate in three dimensions, and the very cream of the crop in geologists operate in four dimensions because we add the time factor. And those are really the ones that I consider practice the art of geology, not only the science, but the best geologists are really artists. And so we combine this. We make a two-dimensional map. We take samples on the surface. We drill or we explore underground in three dimensions. So we're always thinking in cross-sectional view and thinking about putting that drill hole down and what we'll find projected from the surface underground. I call that the old truth tool, and it makes liars out of most geologists at one time or another in their career. Then we come in with the fourth dimension. That's the timing of the mineralizing event in relation to other parts of the geology. Is there, for instance, pre-mineral faulting? Is there post-mineral faulting? And also the critical part of an ore deposit converting from a resource to reserve is the time factor, because what is economic today may or may not be economic tomorrow. We don't know what operating costs are going to be 10 years out. We don't know what the price of metals are going to be next year, let alone what I try to do, predict short-term commodity prices. So anyway, that's the idea. Four dimensions, those are the geologists that are artists and more than scientists.
Fair enough. Before you even perhaps get on the ground, or maybe it's after an initial sortie, there are a number of modern-day techniques that we sometimes read about with projects, radiometric, gravimetric testing, magnetic anomaly testing, and so on. Is that a relatively recent development for prospecting and surveying, and where does it sort of fit in the order of things? Is that something you would do first, or is it something you do once you've found something of interest on the ground?
Well, once again, that would be project specific, but in addition to doing evaluation, I have spent a considerable part of my career doing prospecting and mapping, and I had some success doing that. I am a boot leather and drill guy, so the idea of boots on the ground followed up by drill holes is, I think, the way to go. These geophysical prospecting methods have been around since post-World War II, when magnetometers were developed in World War II. To navigate with, basically, but as time has progressed, they have become more and more developed and better at what they are able to do. So any reconnaissance, grassroots sort of prospecting program will include government magnetic data, government aeromagnetic data, radiometric, that stuff is usually done by governments. When it gets project specific, then companies will come in and do more detailed surveys. But we have been given we have developed over the course of especially about the last 15 years, new remote prospecting tools. Of particular interest is satellite imagery, the Aster 7-band satellite photos. We have developed geophysical techniques, with the helicopter multitasking geophysical surveys, which you just mentioned, radiometric, gravimetric, magnetic stuff. In addition, we have developed remote geochemical programs now where we can take soil samples and stream sediment samples and do remote sort of analysis on those. So our business has become much better at doing these sort of regional targeting sort of scenarios. But you've got to put a geologist on the ground. Boots on the ground is what finds ore bodies.
Fair enough. And how long, again, this is probably project specific, but when you're out taking a look, I mean, how long are you out at any one time in the field as a geologist?
I think you mean from when I leave my office to when I would get home on a prospecting venture. Those usually are quite long. Are relatively long programs, you know, especially when you're working in remote parts of the world. You know, back in my prospecting days, which weren't that long ago, I would commonly leave for 30 to 40 days at a time. So get on a plane, fly to some remote location, and then probably fly someplace else and then go via helicopter or float plane. So travel is an important part of the business. And you have to be dedicated to doing that to be a successful geologist, I think.
Fair enough. Now, you mentioned the Truth Tool. I know there are a variety of drilling technique available when looking to evaluate mineral bodies. Why would the companies choose one over another? I've heard of reverse circulation, rotary percussion, diamond drilling. What's the sort of pros and cons of some of those? Do you have any comments on
Well, we use all of those, and in the list of questions you gave me before we started here, you said auger, rotary, reverse circulation, diamond drilling. Those are all used, and I've used all those. Augering is usually done for shallow samples when there's overburden to be gotten through, essentially sand and gravel or glacial till. And at one time, I've done a lot of things in my career, and the dead time, I call it, between Briex and about 2003, I went into the sand and gravel business, and I developed a sand and gravel deposit north of Albuquerque that is now the largest in New Mexico, and we drilled that with caisson augers, a 3-foot auger, to be able to bring up the sand. And what we are really interested in is the gravel and the size of the gravel. So augering would generally be used to get through overburden or to test something like sand and gravel. Rotary percussion, mud rotary or percussion rotary would be used mainly in the oil and gas business, or also in the uranium business, where you're able to send logging tools down the hole and you don't need exactly reliable samples coming up from the hole. A reverse circulation is often used as a quick and dirty technique to do initial testing, because it basically pounds the rock up into little chips and into dust, and you're not able to put good geological information on it. Instead of looking at a piece or a big core, you're basically looking at little chips, so you cannot gather a good idea of the structural geology, the faults, how the ore occurs within the matrix or the fragments in a rock, for instance. And then finally, the real true tool is diamond drilling, and that's done with a wireline core rig, and you actually recover continuous core, and that is really the best information and almost required information before a deposit could ever be converted from a resource into a reserve.
And I presume the diamond drilling is probably the more expensive of the various options. Is that safe?
Yes, it is, with a caveat that if you're drilling a deep rotary hole for oil and gas, those things become exorbitantly expensive.
Yeah.
Diamond drilling is the most expensive. You're probably looking at all-in diamond drilling costs on average throughout the world now, something on the order of $150 a meter. So it's not cheap.
No, you're right. So when we look at projects, there's a number of stages and terms used in their life cycle, scoping studies, pre-fees, feasibility, and so on. Is there a standard set of terminology for those stages, and what is the order of those stages as a project progresses?
Well, you pretty much listed them in the order. You're first going to come up with generally an inferred resource that will be converted to measured and indicated. At that point, kind of the new flavor of the month for companies now is called a preliminary economic assessment. That's a recognized 43-101 category. Historically, those have been called scoping studies, and historically those were internal documents that were used by the company for a decision point. Does this thing have a prayer of becoming economic, or have we drilled it and killed it? So now these scoping studies are kind of the flavor of the year, and in 43-101 speak, they are called preliminary economic assessments, and that's just a scoping study. From a scoping study, a company that will then go to pre-feasibility stage, and that's the first time that real economic parameters are put on the resource, and that is the point where it can be converted into a reserve. So every pre-feasibility study, whether if positive, will end up with reserves. Then finally, there's the feasibility study, and those are essentially bankable. Some people will call them definitive feasibility studies. In the past, they were always called bankable, but increasingly what we find is that banks are not involved anymore, especially on some of the smaller projects where money is raised internally or through convertible debentures. So the term bankable feasibility study is always been a difficult one. What's bankable to one bank may not be bankable to another bank or another mining company, et cetera. So we see that term kind of going by the wayside. But a feasibility study is the final definitive document at which time financing will be sought. But I have to tell you that even when there are definitive feasibility studies, mining is still a very risky business. I'm of the opinion that of every five mines developed, four will fail miserably, four will trade dollars, and four or five will trade dollars, and two of ten will make windfall profits. So even if a mine has been shown to be economic, only about 20% of those mines will ever return significant, what I would call, windfall profits to the underlying shareholders. So it's a difficult business, but we keep doing it because those two of ten mines make people so rich, and the fact that the world demands resources and commodities. Look at the present prices that we're looking at right now.
Yep. So, Mickey, you've become pretty well known for, you know, your approach to investing in the junior mining sector. It's what I would call a three-pronged approach. For those folks who might on the call that might not be familiar with that, could you perhaps get into that for us?
Sure. I have three criteria for that I evaluate all companies prior to speculation in them. And I should also say that about 98% of those companies fail at any one time or the other. And that share structure, people, and projects. So all three of those need to be right. But being a geologist, there are 1,750 juniors out there. And my job as a speculator and as a newsletter writer, but primarily as a personal speculator, is to eliminate as many of those from consideration as quickly as I can. Being a field geologist, I am able to eliminate 50% of the companies within a few minutes by the fact that their project, in my opinion, is not viable or something I'm not interested in. The share structure, in my opinion, needs to be tight. I have some rules of thumb for the number of shares that are outstanding at any particular stage. So I like a very tight share structure, a low number of shares, and I want to see some cash in the bank with the ability for a junior to go on without for the next year or so without the need to raise money. And finally, some people will say the people are the most important thing, and I would not disagree with that, but I don't think they're any more important than the other two criteria. But the people need to have previous experience in the junior resource sector. I want to see the people in charge, the CEO, the COO, et cetera. I want to see the board of directors to be mainly composed of technical people who have been in this business before, have experience running companies before, and most importantly, have been successful. I do not consider, this is a venture capital game we play, and I do not consider someone who has taken three companies to bankruptcy or has rolled them over into shells three times and you're out, those people I do not consider to be entrepreneurs. The final criteria I put is a peer valuation. So I'm looking for companies that are undervalued at any particular time with respect to their peers. That tells me they have some upside. I'm a contrarian, so I buy things when no one else wants them. I get in early, and so undervalue is a very important part of that criteria.
So is there any one subsector within this whole junior mining space at the moment that, from your viewpoint, is particularly attractive from an investment standpoint right now, bearing in mind that you normally look at, you know, company by company? Is there a particular subsector of real interest for you right now?
Yeah, I'm looking at two sectors right now, and that would be uranium because it's beaten up and out of favor. The world needs uranium. We have a severe supply shortfall, have had for a number of years. So I'm looking at picking away on weakness at some very fundamentally strong uranium companies. The other sector that I'm watching very carefully right now, now bear in mind, I've been watching it carefully for 3 years. I tend to get into these things much earlier than probably I should, but I have patience and I will wait companies out in sectors that are beaten up or are not in favor. So the other sector right now would be the natural gas sector.
Okay. Can you give us maybe a couple of examples of companies and projects that you are particularly interested in and sort of walk us through why they're of interest to you?
Yeah, and so here I will have to tell you that that the companies I'm going to mention I am a shareholder of, and in most instances they will be sponsors of my website, so you are listening to a biased view and opinion, and everyone must do their own due diligence. A company I'm particularly interested in, have been buying on weakness since the Japanese tsunami, is Uranium Energy Corp., a new uranium producer in South Texas with an overall cost of around $20 a pound operating cost for uranium and very low capex on in situ recovery uranium operation. A new company that I took on as a sponsor recently has been Avrupa Minerals, and they are a prospect generator operating in Eastern and Southern Europe. I expect big things from that company in the near term. They are a base metal and tungsten prospect generator. I'm looking seriously at the tungsten sector right now, but I'm finding most of the companies to be overvalued and not of interest. But Avrupa is a name that I'm interested in. Most people probably know I got in the rare earth sector very early on. Most of the companies that I'm involved in, what I call the cream of the crop, I bought at pennies, and now they're at somewhere between $5 and $15. So those are very difficult companies to get involved with at this stage, because I personally don't like a lot of downside risk, so I try to get in early at cheap prices. But some of those companies, and the cream of the crop for me would be Rare Element Resources, Quest Rare Minerals, Tasman Metals Limited, to name three. You know, if you want to pick away of those, there are big upticks and downticks in this sector. These things surge up and then they correct, and they have lots of short selling always against them. So I would suggest, if you want to get involved in those, that you try to put in stink bids and buy them on weakness. A relatively new rare earth element company I've recently become involved with, I've been a shareholder for somewhere on the order of 9 months now. I just covered them in my newsletter a couple of months ago, and that's Medallion Resources. That's still a penny stock. I'm interested in them because of what they're going to try to do, what they tell the market they're going to do, which is kind of shortcut, leapfrog the other nearly 200 juniors out there, that many of which claim to be rare earth element explorers. Medallion is one of those, but they're trying to get into monazite-bearing sands and take heavy mineral sands tails and recover the monazite from them. And Jack will certainly corroborate the fact that monazite is one of the three minerals that has ever been successfully cracked for its rare earths. In addition, Medallion's looking for another, for a heavy ionic clay deposit somewhere in the Amazon basin. We think they're fairly close to make an acquisition in that regard. So there's three relatively new ideas for me.
Now, buy and hold versus trading, what's your thoughts on philosophy there?
Buy and hold doesn't work in the junior resource sector. You have to be a trader to be successful. I have a philosophy called the power of two, and that's when a stock doubles, and I expect everything I buy to double in 12 months or less. When it doubles, I sell half, take my money off the table. I'm playing with house money, someone else's money, maybe even your money at that time, Gareth. But to go to zero cost basis and then play your remaining half your shares for the upside is a great philosophy. I also do programmed open orders to sell on the uptick, and I set what I call profit stops on the downtick. So I am selling and buying and selling stock all the time. I always find something to be long on. Buy and hold just basically doesn't work as a philosophy in the junior resource sector, because something on the order of 95% of these companies or more will eventually fail.
I believe Jack may have a question here. Let me see if he's not lost in the bowels of New York City. Let me see if I can bring him up. Jack, are you there? Jack? No? Okay. Sorry, Jack. Maybe email me a message if you have access to the keyboard. So we've got a few questions here that folks have sent in, and certainly anyone on the call that wants to ask Mickey a question, you're welcome to do so. Dial 5 and then star on your keyboard just to let me know. But back in, I think it was September 2009, you wrote what I thought was a great piece on your article called The Trouble with Geologists, which I think did a great job in pinpointing a key issue with the junior mining sector. Could you maybe just distill down for us the message of that piece and why it's important for potential investors in this sector?
Yeah, certainly. Most geologists are field types, and they don't feel comfortable in a suit. And in the corporate boardroom and on the sell side in front of brokers and analysts and funds. So it takes a very special geologist who can combine the ability to evaluate projects in the field and successfully convert those ideas into financing in the junior resource sector. The trouble with most geologists, and it goes back to the fact that there are so few prospects we ever look at that actually will ever make a mine or even have the potential to make a mine. Geologists tend to be loners, if you will, and perhaps not always gregarious people, because the odds of failure are so high, or I like to say the chances of success are so low, geologists become eternal optimists. So they have to think that across the next valley or over on the other side of that mountain, they're going to find the mother lode. So they tend to become blinded by their eternal optimism. Think how hard it is to stay up for what you're doing when you have something on the order of any day you go out about a 1 in 10,000 chance of finding something that's going to eventually make a mine. So because of that, it really becomes the trouble with geologists, and geologists oftentimes end up with projects that they fall in love with. And so it takes sort of a special kind of guy that can make that transition or go back and forth between wearing his camo fatigues and carrying a rock hammer and his boots, and the next day basically end up in a $1,200 suit in front of some analysts or brokers in Vancouver, Toronto, or New York City. So anybody interested, the piece was written with some humor involved, and it got great play, and it probably is going to end up being a series of the trouble with us, and there's going to be one called the trouble with engineers and the trouble with lawyers and the trouble with accountants and and eventually we might put those all together and publish them. So for those interested, it's available on my website.
Great. Well, we have a few questions here that have been sent in, and I'll try and paraphrase some of these. The first one is from Orvi, and the question is, what deposit, a placer or lode, is the most feasible and would cost the least to produce?
Yeah, well, the placer deposits can be very profitable, but the trouble with placer deposits is they are very difficult to evaluate. It's very difficult to put economic numbers on them. There's an old saying in the mining business, if you're mining a gold placer, you know if you have found any gold when the mine is done. So essentially, I do not think that placer deposits, and I'm talking specifically gold placer deposits, are viable in the public venue. Those should be kept private and done privately. And I know some very successful placer gold miners in the Yukon and in Alaska, and people that read my stuff and listen to me know I'm a dedicated nugget buyer, and I buy from people who have been placering in those areas for years and made a lot of money at it. But that does not transfer very well into the public company sector.
Fair enough. Okay. The next question is about graphite. Late graphite.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. There was, and I'm going to read this, there was buzz following the recent Focus Metals presentation, with the stock jumping 20% after the presentation, but has been heading south since. Later, Discovery Investing's Dr. Michael Berry made a credible presentation on the Northern Graphite story after its IPO, but now after the run-up past a dollar, the stock appears to be heading south. Could you give any comments or advice on this sector?
Yeah, sure. This is the normal course of events. A company comes out, it's got a new idea, it kind of catches the fancy of some newsletter writers and media and speculators, and the stock runs up and the stock goes back down. So the key to those sorts of things is to get in early and take your profits quickly on those, because that's the normal way things go. They go up too far and then they go down too far, and then they'll eventually reach some reasonable speculation. So it's not only restricted to the graphite business. Graphite's an interesting commodity. The long flake graphite is in great demand, and there's not enough of it. Once again, we saw China come in and basically take over the graphite market by flooding the market with cheap exports over a number of years. So graphite is something I'm looking at right now. I have not particularly followed the Focus or the Northern Graphite stories, and I would prefer not to comment on those. But I can tell you that I am involved, and we'll see. It's on the cusp right now, but I'm trying to, or let me put it this way, a group of people that I am associated with is trying to develop a new graphite play. So we may come on with an IPO or a new company in the graphite sector within the short to midterm.
Interesting. Okay, we have time for one other question here. Let's see. This is from Edwin. Probably knew you weren't going to get away with a call like this without somebody asking about Molycorp and Lynas.
Okay.
So here's the question. It appears that Molycorp and Lynas will be the government-supported consolidation vehicles aimed at meeting free world demand for rare earths. These two will likely use their market cap as currency. In Edwin's opinion, both deposits seem unattractive economically, so they'll have to make acquisitions. Does the Molycorp Estonia processing mill, and I think that's a reference to the recent acquisition of Silmet,
yeah,
does that not seem like an obvious move to stage a takeout of Tasman? it gets better. Considering Lynas is shipping ore to Malaysia profitably, could Tasman ship from Sweden to Estonia if they do not plan to take out Tasman? How do they plan to control this portion of the business? A lot in there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's a multi-phase question. So I will strongly disagree with him that Molycorp and Lynas do not have economic deposits. Mountain Pass is absolutely the highest grade and best light rare earth deposit in the world. It's produced before. It's got a grade of somewhere on the order of 9%, which is 2 times the grade at more or less 2 times the grade at Lynas at Mount Weld. It also is about well over 2 times the grade of rare earth elements or rare element resources Bear Lodge deposit. It is the best deposit. It was the world's dominant producer for something on the order of 40 years, and it will come back. Molycorp's acquisition of Silmet, I think, caught everybody by surprise. I think it is a great acquisition. In that regard, I will be visiting Silmet. I'll be one of the first gringos ever to see it, I think, behind David O'Brock, who runs the company, and Kevin Kerr, the commodities trader out of Tallinn, Estonia, and Clint Cox, of course, who's been everywhere. But I'll be on the ground there in about 4 weeks, I guess. And the question about Tasman, as people probably know, I cover Tasman. I was a founding shareholder of Tasman Metals Limited, so I have a very vested interest in seeing that company successful. I have also wondered if Molycorp would have its eyes on Tasman, because the thing Molycorp's missing right now is a heavy rare earth element deposit. That said, Silmet is a plant that only produces a light rare earth concentrate. It has the capability and has an past produced what's called a SEG concentrate, a middle rare earth, samarium, europium, gadolinium, but they would have to put in a new circuit. From what I have seen, I've seen an hour-long video by Kevin Kerr with David O'Brock about SILMET. It looks like a very well-run operation. It's state-of-the-art. There's intellectual capital there. I have speculated that maybe the acquisition was to acquire the intellectual capital because I think that people in that part of the world would probably very much like to live in Las Vegas or Barstow, California, versus living in Silmé, Estonia. That's just pure speculation. Molycorp is going to be the big boy on the block. It's the 800-pound gorilla. I don't think Molycorp needs U.S. government intervention or subsidies. I am not familiar enough with Lynas to know if the Australian government will subsidize its effort. Its problem right now is the separation plant in Malaysia, and that's why you've seen some delays from initial estimates about when they would be in production and successfully marketing rare earths.
Great. Well, let me just quickly ask you two last questions here, and then we'll wrap things up. One of which is, this is the one that Jack was trying to ask earlier. Basically, he's asking if you made a comment about Russian and Chinese data in the past. Have things improved in terms of the contemporary data gathering and analysis with Russian and Chinese data, or has there not been any progress, do you think?
Well, what we're dealing with yet, time and time again, is that data is historic data, and it cannot be relied upon. Certainly, if Canadian-based companies or Australian-based companies, for that matter, move in to the former Soviet Union, the satellite republics, the so-called CIS, and generate new data, there's every reason to believe that data will be good. But most of what's used and what is or available is historic data, and a good example would be the data at Kudasay 2, which, if you look at that, and this is a company called Stans Energy. They just raised $28 million, announced yesterday. But you look at that deposit. I have been told by an expat who lives in the East Coast of the United States right now, has built something on the order of 20 chemical plants in Russia, that Kudasay has been 80% mined out. But you look at the grade of that thing, and it's about 0.24% total rare earths. And my question is, how could anybody think that would ever be economic? We're looking at maybe one-fifth of the grade of competitors in other parts of the world, and if it's 80% mined out, I just don't see it. And that's also, you're looking at data that was generated in Soviet era, and they don't have the sort of, never had the sort of resource and reserve categories that have been used in the West. There was no economic parameters put on it. Russian government says, we need heavy rare earths, and we know there's some here, mine it, so the cost was immaterial.
I do believe Stans did recently publish JORC-compliant data for that project, but I'm not sure if it was based on new drilling or whether it was an interpretation of the existing data or not. But
yeah, I can answer that and tell you there was no new drilling. They did some underground sampling, but even still, it's much too low grade to make an economic mine.
Okay. One last question then, if I can squeeze it in. We have a question from Brad who says, this is, I'm sure, a question everyone's wondering, will Peter Cashin and his team at Quest take Strange Lake to a mine, or are they going to get acquired? If so, when would you expect that to happen?
And that's from Brian?
That's from Brad, someone called Brad.
Oh, Brad, I'm sorry. Well, Brad, I'd say your guess is as good as mine. I am a dedicated shareholder of Quest. In fact, I probably drank a few brews in the bar in Toronto on Monday evening with Peter. whether they get acquired, I'll go back and say unequivocally that these junior resource companies with the big deposits, and that would be include Quest and Avalon and Rare Element and Tasman, they do not have the financial wherewithal to develop mines without partners, without strategic partners, offtake contracts, business combinations, joint ventures, and or outright takeouts. And until those sorts of things happen, it's pure speculation. But Quest's not going to be able to raise whatever they need. I can't remember what the scoping study says, but they're going to need something on the order of $500 million plus to develop Strange Lake, and they don't have the financial wherewithal to do that. So you're going to see partnering, and John Keisner and I are both in agreement that next year is going to be the time of mergers and acquisitions and combinations and contracts and strategic alliances, some consolidation of the rare earth element sector.
Well, thank you for that, Mickey. Time as usual has flown by, and I'm afraid we've come to the end of our call today. I want to thank you very much, Mickey, for joining us on the discussion today. As a reminder, you can read Mickey's thoughts and observations about life, the universe, and everything associated with junior mining at his website, which is mercenarygeologist.com. You can also visit the TMR website, too, at techmetalsresearch.com. So thank you again, Mickey.
Well, thank you very much, Gareth. And I have to say that your series of questions were stimulating to me, and I very much enjoyed doing this.
Great. Thank you. And finally, I want to thank everyone listening for dialing in today. And for joining us, and we wish you a good weekend, and thank you and goodbye.